Okay, so last time we finished off, we were just talking about alpha-1 receptors. So let's do a quick recap on alpha-1 receptors. So first thing is we want to draw our little alien. And our alien has alpha-1 receptors in the eyes. So when you stimulate those receptors, whether naturally or with the drug, we're going to get what effects happening. So we're going to have mydriasis, or we're going to have widening of the pupil. And what is that? What purpose does that serve physiologically? Why would we want the pupils to be larger during a sympathetic or stress response? Okay, so more light can come in, which makes it easier to see, particularly in dark situations. So for much of humanity's life, we did not have something called a light bulb. So if something went bump in the night, what do you have to do? See in the dark. So sympathetic response helps you to see better in low light situations. Now the downside is it makes it harder to concentrate and see, focus up close. Because you can't focus, in order to focus the eye, you've got to constrict the pupils. All right, so that's one. And then we also have, here's the rest of our alien. So he's also got alpha-1 receptors in the skin, and in the skin and also in the gut. So in both of those places, what effect are we going to have? Vasoconstriction. Now, what is the purpose of that vasoconstriction? Okay, so we're going to shunt the blood out of the skin and the gut. So when you have a stress response, you don't necessarily need to have blood going to your skin and to digest food at that moment in time. You probably want it somewhere else. Now, that somewhere else is going to be the muscles, but alpha-1 is not responsible for that. So be careful about saying we're going to shunt blood to the muscles. Well, alpha-1 just shunts blood away from skin and from the gut. Now, what terms, in terms of symptoms or signs, what symptoms or signs might be associated with those two things? So in the skin, what would happen to a person's skin? Become more pale and lighter skinned, so pallor. And then with darker skinned patients, typically they become kind of grayish color, and the word for that is ashen. Now, with the GI tract, what sort of symptoms might a person associate with that decreased blood flow to the GI tract? Say again? Okay, not so much. Just there's less blood flow to your GI tract. So what kind of symptom might a person experience? Okay, so butterflies in the stomach on the light end, moving to nausea, and then eventually could actually lead to vomiting. And I think I mentioned the movie Any Given Sunday, one of Jamie Foxx's first movies, where he's the backup quarterback, and anytime he gets to go on the field, the nerves of being on national television and about to make this giant play, he vomits on the field and it becomes like a big joke. So sympathetic response in the GI tract can lead from anything to butterflies in your stomach all the way up through nausea. Now, one other thing to mention is that if the vasoconstriction is severe enough for long enough, it can actually cause ischemia in the bowel, which can... What is ischemia, by the way? It's decreased blood flow to the point where you cause problems. And so that you can actually get ulcers being caused by sympathetic response and vasoconstriction. So that would be in a severe case, like say perhaps a burn, you know, large burns or gunshot wounds, something like that. But just, you know, being nervous over a test or a race or being scared, that's not typically associated with that. We're talking about severe physiologic stress would be what's necessary to cause that kind of bowel ischemia. All right. So then there's one more place that we have alpha-1, and that is in the urethra. So that's supposed to be the bladder. Urethra goes through there, and you get constriction of the urethra, which makes it harder to use the bathroom when you're nervous. And you may have experienced that sometime in your life if, say, if you're an athlete and you have to pee in a cup so that we can prove that you're not on performance-enhancing drugs. And so they have to watch you pee in a cup. Here's one of the things. If you let someone go to the bathroom in the cup to do drug tests and you don't observe them do it, you might as well not have done the drug test at all. It's so easy to fake unless you actually see them perform the deed. So what happens nowadays in sports is they actually have to watch you go to the bathroom. And so you're like, can't do it. Why not? You're watching me. Can't do it. And that the reason for that is because of this vasoconstriction. So, therapeutically, what can we use alpha-1 for? Stimulating alpha-1, what can we use it for? Well, the first thing is, if we need to dilate a person's eyes, you can do that. But usually that's not what we use it for. What we really use it for, the drug that we'd actually use to do the dilating would be an anticholinergic. So here we have, you can either block choline receptors, get mydriasis, or you can stimulate alpha-1, get mydriasis. When it comes to drugs that we use for that, most of the time we're using an anticholinergic, not an alpha-1 stimulant. Does that make sense? So, when it comes to vasoconstriction, the main thing that we would use vasoconstriction for is local surgery. So, let's say for a moment that you go into your doctor's office and you've got a mole or a skin tag and they're going to remove it. What's going to happen to your skin afterwards? You're going to bleed, right. And so we can use epinephrine in that little area to reduce bleeding. So by vasoconstricting that area, you can reduce bleeding. So a lot of times you'll see lidocaine 2% with epi and lidocaine 2% without epi. So when it has the epi in it, epinephrine, remember, stimulates alpha-1, and that would cause a decrease in bleeding. Another potential use for vasoconstriction would be if a patient's blood pressure is too low. So we talked last time about shock. And so if a person is in shock, you can use alpha-1 stimulants to raise a person's blood pressure. And so most of the time it's going to be a catecholamine, and it's either going to be norepinephrine or dopamine. You can also use phenylephrine in an IV drip for that purpose as well. The only time you're doing that is in the ICU, the intensive care unit. So, norepinephrine has a brand name, Levofed, with a nickname, Levomdead. And then dopamine has a nickname, Nohopamine. Now, those nicknames were earned in the late 70s, early 80s, when those drugs were fairly new, and we were new to this whole concept of, you know, these super traumatic patients where they're knocking on death's door already, and now we wait too long to use the drugs. Nowadays, we are much more aggressive at using those drugs, so the patients are going to have a much higher chance of surviving than in the old days. But people still remember those nicknames, and they're fun nicknames for nursing students to memorize, so hey, maybe it helps you remember the drugs. So, when it comes to the vasoconstriction, we can either reduce bleeding, and the drug for that is epi. We can also raise blood pressure, usually in shock patients. And the two drugs that would be used there, well, I guess the three drugs that would be used there, norepinephrine, dopamine, and phenylephrine. And we don't really use this as a therapeutic measure. So the biggest use for alpha-1 drugs is going to be in this vasoconstriction area. Now, in terms of adverse effects, you also have alpha-1 receptors in your nose, and in your nose, when you stimulate them, you also get vasoconstriction. So we do have another therapeutic effect there, in that if a person has a lot of nasal congestion, you can give them an alpha-1 stimulant, and it will help with that. So, drug of choice there would be either pseudoephedrine or phenylephrine. And we talked last time about Breaking Bad and how the government thinks that you're all meth cooks. And that's why you have to have the pseudoephedrine, which can be used to make crystal meth. that's now behind the pharmacy. You have to ask for it. You have to scan your driver's license. And you can only get a certain amount of it each month. So, pseudoephedrine is a slightly more effective drug than phenylephrine for nasal congestion. But because it can be used to make crystal meth, nowadays it's restricted, and so almost everyone is taking phenylephrine, which is an older, not as effective drug. So if you ever see something in the hospital or in the pharmacy that is like something D, so Mucinex D, Claritin D, Allegra D, the D means decongestant, and it used to be pseudoephedrine, but nowadays it's going to be phenylephrine. In terms of the two drugs, they both work the same way in that they stimulate alpha-1 and reduce nasal congestion. But they work differently in terms of how long they work and how effective they are. So phenylephrine doesn't work as long and it's not as effective. You can also use phenylephrine intranasally, like so, and it doesn't work. It works better that way topically, but it also is associated with what's called rebound congestion. So as soon as it wears off, you actually end up worse than you were to begin with. And in the case, just in the interest of completion, there's another drug, oxymetazoline, which you do not have to memorize, which is Afrin. And that's another nasal one. You've probably seen Afrin in the pharmacy. So take it topically and it makes your nose go open. That is also associated with rebound decongestion, but the rebound typically doesn't occur until you've been using it for about 3 days. So, in terms of hospital stuff, so that last oxymetazoline stuff, that's for your friends and family. Because how many of you already have family members who are like, hey, you're in nursing school, what should I do about... Yeah, I see you laugh. So, yes, you already have had that happen. So, you need to be able to give them an answer. So, like, what should I do for my cold? Well, you can take some pseudoephedrine, but you have to go to the pharmacy and give them your driver's license. Or you can take some phenylephrine. It's not quite as good. Or you could use oxymetazoline, also known as Afrin, but don't use it for more than 3 days, because after 3 days, your risk of rebound congestion goes way up. Rebound congestion? What's that? Well, that's when you stop using the drug and you get even worse off than you were before. Oh, okay. You're so smart, they teach you everything in nursing school. See how that conversation goes? No, I don't know. What are they teaching you in nursing school? You're stupid. That's not the conversation you want to have. So, in terms of nasal decongestants, those are the two main ones, phenylephrine, pseudoephedrine. In terms of hospital-based stuff, and also local outpatient surgery, epinephrine for local surgery, and then for shock, dopamine and norepinephrine and phenylephrine. Now, in terms of adverse effects, what do you think some adverse effects could be of causing alpha-1 stimulation? What's the number one adverse effect, do you think? Necrosis. If you vasoconstrict the blood vessels too much, you can actually cause death of the tissue. Now, the death of the tissue is primarily going to be in extremities, fingers and nose, penis and toes, and kidneys. Kidneys need an enormous amount of blood flow in order to work. When you cause vasoconstriction of the renal arteries, it can kick the patient over into renal failure. So when you have a patient on norepinephrine, that is by far the number one drug with the most risk of necrosis of the extremities. The extremities will actually become black and can fall off just like a patient with severe frostbite. So you also need to monitor the patient's renal function when they're on a catecholamine like dopamine or norepinephrine. Come on in. Mm-hmm. Are you here for the lecture, Libby? All right. Everyone's here for the lecture now. All right, so they're going to cut that part out, by the way. Or not. Hi. Hi, Mom. Okay, So that is what happens when we stimulate alpha-1. There is one other use for stimulating alpha-1 that I need to mention, and that is epinephrine and anaphylactic shock. So if you have a patient who is in anaphylactic shock, what causes anaphylactic shock, first of all? I don't know. An allergic reaction. So it's the most severe type of allergic reaction, and it's super hyperacute. We talked about some movies that are associated with that, like My Girl, where Macaulay Culkin dies from the bee sting. So sometimes food allergies can cause it. Sometimes it's bee sting. Sometimes it's something else altogether. Sometimes it's a drug allergy. Whatever the reason, if a person is in anaphylactic shock, what is usually the cause of death? Airway constriction. So the person gets swelling of their trachea, and then that prevents them from being able to breathe. Now, where does the fluid from swelling come from? Blood vessels. Blood vessels. Blood vessels, right! So, what happens is you get a vasodilation of certain blood vessels. And there's more to it. We'll go over that later. But what epinephrine does by causing vasoconstriction is it constricts those blood vessels and it helps to make the edema smaller. And that's what saves a person's life. So, epinephrine in the form of an EpiPen, typically, brand name anyway, is what we would use to treat anaphylactic shock. So, basically, epinephrine subcutaneous. Does that make sense? All right. So now let's talk over here about what happens when we block alpha-1. So when you block alpha-1, you're going to get the opposite of mydriasis. You can end up in meiosis. And in the skin and the gut and the nose, you're going to prevent vasoconstriction and you're going to cause vasodilation. And then in the urethra, you're going to end up with relaxation or dilation of the urethra. So, therapeutically, we don't really have a use for the eye. Do we have a use for vasodilation therapeutically? Yes, you could use it to lower blood pressure, but there have been several studies done where patients who we use alpha-1 blockers to reduce their blood pressure don't necessarily have improved death rates and heart attack rates over patients with other drugs. So it's very rare that you're actually going to see someone on an alpha blocker just for that reason. So it could happen, but in reality, that's not what you're going to see most of the time. Now, there are some cases where we do want to vasodilate a person to prevent necrosis. And the three big ones there are, number one would be epitoxicity. So let's say or norepinephrine toxicity. So let's say for a moment you've got a patient who's in the ICU and they're in shock and we've been giving them norepinephrine, vasoconstricts, raises their blood pressure, we save their life, but their toes are beginning to fall off. You could use an alpha-1 blocker to help reduce that. Let's say someone goes in for some local surgery and they get lidocaine with epi, and the skin around that area begins to turn dark. Well, what do you think might be happening? Well, it reduced bleeding by causing vasoconstriction, and then went a step further and began to kill the tissue by not allowing blood to get there. So, rather than let that tissue die, we could administer an alpha-1 blocker to help reverse that toxicity. So, we can use it to reverse the epinephrine, norepinephrine toxicity, and we can also use it to treat two other conditions that are associated with tissue necrosis. So the first one is called Raynaud's phenomenon or Raynaud's disease. So we're not really sure exactly what causes Raynaud's, but it results in extreme vasoconstriction of the fingers and toes. And when it's severe enough, can actually cause necrosis of fingers and toes. So you can treat Raynaud's patients with a block alpha-1 blocker and help prevent that. The last one is a tumor called a pheochromocytoma. So pheochromocytoma is a tumor of the adrenal medulla. Now, what does the adrenal medulla produce? Epinephrine. So if you have a tumor of the gland that produces epinephrine, what might the tumor produce? Too much epinephrine. So a patient who's got too much epinephrine running around their body is going to be at risk for a lot of different things, including necrosis of their extremities. So you can use an alpha-1 blocker to treat pheochromocytoma. So for these three purposes, the drug of choice is called phenethylamine. I also know a nurse who stuck herself with an EpiPen and her fingers got all white because of that. You know, and it got cold and, oh no, they might die. And so she didn't go to the emergency room, but the next day she talked to some friends who worked in the emergency room and they're like, oh yeah, we can treat that with phenethylamine. And she's like, did you know that there's a drug you can use? I'm like, yeah, I teach that to the students every year. You do? Yes, you guys are so smart. So phenethylamine is used for reducing or preventing epinephrine type toxicity. Now, most of the time, the reason you're going to see a patient on an alpha-1 blocker is for down here, the dilation of the urethra. Unfortunately, men have this little thing we call a prostate. So, everyone started out as a girl before they were born. So, the only thing that separates boys from girls is a Y chromosome, right? Right? Genetically speaking, it's a Y chromosome. What does the Y chromosome do? You should know that one. So the Y chromosome tells the little proto-ovaries in the little fetus to become testicles or orchids. So then the testicles begin to, or testes, I guess they're called at that point because they haven't descended yet, are called, they start to produce testosterone. And it's the testosterone that turns that little fetus into a little boy. In the absence of that testosterone, the little fetus becomes a girl. So we all started out as girls and then we become boys if we have a Y chromosome that codes to turn the proto-ovaries into testes and the testes produce testosterone. Does that make sense? So, the prostate, if it didn't become a prostate for a boy, would have become a uterus. So that's where the kind of like similar structures. But the prostate, so here's the bladder right here, and the prostate is right below it, and the urethra runs right through it. Now, for better or for worse, there, as a man gets older, the prostate begins to grow bigger. It's called benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH. So as it grows bigger on the outside, it also grows bigger inwards. And so you begin to make this little tube smaller, which makes it harder to go to the bathroom. If you've ever seen the movie Zoolander, Jerry Stiller's character is always trying to go to the bathroom and he can't go. And he's always talking to him, come on, go! Now, I'm not suggesting you should watch Zoolander just for that scene. Oh, it's a terrible movie, but it's very quotable. But anyway, that's what's happening there, is that he can't go to the bathroom because he's got this narrowing of his urethra. Now, there's a number of treatments for it. And the only one that we're interested in at this time, because we're doing neuro, is by blocking alpha-1 receptors, you can relax that tube and make it a little bit easier to go to the bathroom. So the drug that would do that, well, then one of the drugs that we use for that is called tamsulosin. Now, the reason that we use tamsulosin in particular, it's got a brand name of Flomax, which is kind of suggestive. So the reason we would use tamsulosin over another one of the alpha-1 blockers is that it has less of the general vasodilation adverse effects or side effects. So in the case of phenethylamine, we are targeting vasodilation. In the case of tamsulosin, we are targeting urethral dilation. And we don't want vasodilation. What would that cause? side effects or potentially adverse effects. So by causing vasodilation, what do you do to blood pressure? It could decrease. Now, how many have ever had this happen to you? You're lying down in bed, and all of a sudden something happens. You're like, oh, I got to get up. And you get up, and you're like, ooh. Okay, I'm okay. But for a second there, it felt like you might faint, or you're a little dizzy. Maybe the lights kind of went dim for a second, and then, okay, I'm good. Ever happened to you? Okay. So what happened is, when you're lying down, the blood is distributed all over your body at the same time. So your blood vessels are a little bit dilated so that the blood can be evenly dispersed. When you get up, what happens to the blood? There's a little thing you like to call gravity, and it pulled it down to your feet. And all of a sudden, there wasn't enough blood in your brain. And your brain went, oh, freak out! To get the blood back, it was about to have you pass out so you would fall down flat again. But we had sympathetic response, alpha-1 receptors kick in, and the blood vessels in your leg go, and that pushes blood back up into your brain, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm good. Does that sound fair? Now, let's put it together with what you've learned in health assessment. What do we call it when you take a person's blood pressure, lying down and sitting up and standing up? What are you looking for? Orthostatic hypotension. What's the definition of orthostatic hypotension? Okay, but what's the criteria? How big does the blood pressure change have to be? 10 millimeters systolic. If it's lower between the lying and the standing, that's considered orthostatic hypotension. Now, here's the two big things that cause orthostatic hypotension. Number one, vasodilation drugs, especially alpha-1 blockers. Number two, not enough blood volume. So in this case, when we have a patient who's getting one of these alpha-1 blockers, what is a really big thing they're at risk for? Say again?
Falling
when they get up. So patients are at risk for falls because when they get up, they aren't able to adjust their blood pressure as quickly. So what would we tell a patient to do to help prevent that problem? One, get up slowly. So, don't just get up and go. Get up and sit on the side of the bed. And then, what's the fancy word for that? What are legs doing? They're dangling over the side. They call it dangling. So, teach your patient to dangle. So, sit on the side of the bed for a few minutes. Yeah, some patients can take up to 10 minutes before it really gets well. And then have them get up slowly and go. Now, one of the big problems with this is that, the other thing we would do is we would tell them to take it at night. Why at night? Because the drug is going to be strongest at night, so your risk of orthostatic hypotension would be strongest at night. So hopefully you sleep during the time when you're most at risk. So that way you're less likely to have it when you wake up. Now, what's the problem with BPH patients? If you can't empty your bladder fully, because it's hard to go to the bathroom, what do? You go more often. And that means waking up to go in the middle of the night. One of the ways we know we measure severity of BPH is how often you get up in the middle of the night to go. So if you're telling them, take this drug at night, so that you'll sleep when you're having the highest risk of it. But now this patient has to get up in the middle of the night. What happens? Raise their risk of falls. So it's kind of like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But generally speaking, you still tell them to take it at night. But if you have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, what do you have to do? Sit on the side of the bed for 5 minutes. Oh, that ain't going to happen, nurse, because I got to go. Okay, well, what can you do as a result then? Okay, so you could give them a little urinal. What's a urinal? It's like a little cup with a handle and a lid, so they can just sit on the side of the bed, go to sleep again. So that is probably the ideal solution for a patient who's got to get up in the middle of the night. And since I forgot to mention it a second ago, the opposite of this problem, when we stimulate vasodilation, the way we stimulate constriction, we stimulate alpha-1 receptors, is that it can raise a person's blood pressure. So if we have a person who's got high blood pressure and they're taking phenylephrine or pseudoephedrine for their nasal congestion, what do you think could happen to their blood pressure? When you squeeze the blood vessel, what happens to the blood pressure? It goes up. So if you have a patient who's already got high blood pressure and you take a drug that causes vasoconstriction, what could that do to their blood pressure? It could make it even higher. So as a result, we have to use decongestants with caution in patients with high blood pressure. What does that mean, to use with caution? I don't know. This is a dangerous pill. I gotta take it carefully. Is that what we mean? What do we mean? How do you take a drug with caution? Monitor their blood pressure. Okay, you can take the decongestant, but first of all, someone said low dose, that's a good idea. Take a low dose to start and monitor your blood pressure. If your blood pressure starts going up, don't take any more, call the physician or your other healthcare provider. Does that make sense? So that's what we mean by take with caution. Any questions about alpha-1 stimulators or blockers? So we've talked about how many stimulators over here on this side? Not three. Five. Three catecholamines, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epi, and then two decongestants, phenylephrine and pseudoephedrine. And then I gave you a bonus oxymetazoline that you don't really need to know except when your family asks you about it. How many alpha blockers did we learn over here? Two, phentolamine and tamsulosin. 99% of the time, you see a patient on an alpha-1 blocker, what are they being treated for? BPH, benign prostatic hypertrophy, or hyperplasia. Now, guaranteed that it's not BPH if your patient is what? Female. Because females don't have prostates. All right. Any questions about alpha-1 blockers? Because we're going to move on to beta. All right. It's like the worst eraser in the whole world. Alright, now, for beta, when we draw our little alien outline, we've got to draw it with the muscle. And we'll see why in a few minutes. Alright, so first thing we have is we've got our little alien with the muscle, kind of. It's a very ugly alien. So, in the case of beta-1, which is what we're going to be talking about first, beta-1, one heart. Say, two lungs. Good. Two lungs, one heart. Two lungs, one heart. Two lungs, one heart. Two lungs, one heart. Say it. You know why I make you say things? Because you remember it better when you say it. And if you say it like this, two lungs, one heart, you'll probably remember it more than if you say it like this. Okay, so two lungs, one heart. Beta-1, one heart. So we have beta-1 in the heart. And here we're going to get three effects. So the first one is we are going to increase the heart rate. Now, what's the fancy word for a drug that increases heart rate? Positive chronotropic effect, or chronotropic drug. Then we have increasing the force of contraction. So what kind of organ is your heart in the first place? It's a muscle. And What do muscles do? They contract. And that takes or generates force. So the force of contraction is increased with beta 1 stimulation. And the fancy word for a drug that affects that is inotropic. Now, because it's getting stronger and not weaker, what direction is it? Positive. Chronotropic. All right, and then the last one is, there's an electrical induction system in the heart. You guys probably remember it from ANP2. So what are the five components of that conduction system? SA node, AV node, bundle of hist, Purkinje fibers, and then the last step, the heart muscle itself, the myocardium. So that conduction system actually speeds up when you stimulate beta 1. And that is called dromotropic, which is conduction. I wrote that backwards, but hey, you got it. You probably understand what I mean. Conduction. All right, so dromotropic effect is when you increase or decrease conduction. So, when you have a sympathetic response, your body is naturally going to do these things right now. How many of you like to exercise? Okay. When you exercise, your body needs more cardiac output. It needs your heart to pump more blood to fuel your exercise, right? The muscles need more blood. So in order to provide that more blood, your heart is stimulated through beta 1 receptors, and that's going to increase the heart rate and the force of contraction and the electrical conductivity. We can also stimulate those with drugs as well. Now, before we get too far, let's just mention that also you have beta 1 receptors in your kidneys, but for the most part, you can ignore that. It's just there because sometimes patients or students like to think of themselves as attorneys more than as students. So if I don't tell you that, the one day one of you like, well, Dr. Heyman, you said that it was just in the heart, and it turns out that there's beta 1 in the kidneys too. Well, yes, that's true. There's actually beta 1 in other tissues as well. But for this class and for most of your nursing career in the next 5 years, what's important is that beta 1 is present in your heart. So, one, heart. And it causes these three effects. Does that make sense? All right. So, let's talk about some times where we would want to increase your beta 1 stimulation with a drug. First of all, on that list that you have, the little chart, which neurotransmitters stimulate, and drugs, stimulate beta 1? Epi, norepi, dopamine, and dobutamine. Now, out of that list, which one only affects the heart? Only affects beta 1? Dobutamine. All of these others also affect beta 1. Sorry, alpha 1. So all of the others also cause vasoconstriction. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, there's a couple things we can use these for. The first one is, and this goes back to some of those differences we talked about last class. I put on the board a little slide that talked about the difference between heart failure and cardiac arrest. Did we talk about that last time? Or did I dream it? You're not sure. Okay. Well, we'll put it up right now just to make sure. So, in your notes, there's a slide that talks about a brief detour. And it talks about what blood pressure is. So the first thing is, what's the purpose of blood pressure? Push blood through the body. And we push blood through an organ. What's the fancy word for that? What do we do to that organ when we push blood through it? It starts with a P. Perfuse or perfusion. So the purpose of blood pressure is to perfuse the body's organs and tissues. When blood pressure drops to the point where it can no longer do that, What do we call that? Shock. And what are the five kinds of shock? So the first one is there's not enough blood in the system. Hypovolemia. Volemia is short, or is put together for volume, emia. So the amount of blood volume, emia in the blood. So the low blood volume, hypovolemia. What do you think the treatment for hypovolemia would be? Give fluids. Also stop the loss. So if the patient's bleeding, what do we want to do? Stop the bleeding, replace fluids. If the person is has too much diuresis, so they're losing their blood, they're losing blood volume because they're going to the bathroom too much, peeing too much, what would you do? Try and stop the diuresis and replace fluids. If the patient's got diarrhea and that's why they're hypovolemic, what would you want to do? Stop the diarrhea and replace fluids. Okay, so stop whatever's causing the loss, replace the fluids. Pretty simple. The next one was cardiogenic shock. So in cardiogenic shock, what's the problem? The heart just isn't pumping enough blood to maintain perfusion. How do you think we could help a patient with that? Oh. So, patients in cardiogenic shock can be treated with norepi, dopamine, or dobutamine.
Which
three? So, the bottom three.
Oh.
Technically, you can use epi too, but you really don't. So, if your patient, their heart's pumping, but it's not able to maintain their blood pressure because the heart's just too weak or too slow, what three drugs could we use to improve that cardiogenic shock? Norepinephrine, dopamine, dobutamine. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but I just told you a very important thing you should know for your test and for life. It's one thing to say, Dr. Heyman, the treatment for cardiogenic shock is dobutamine, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Thank you. It's another to recognize what that means. So if you have a patient who's having the signs and symptoms of shock, or just the description of the patient's heart can no longer meet the body's demands for perfusion. And then you go, oh wait, that's cardiogenic shock. Dr. Heyman, the treatments for cardiogenic shock are norepinephrine, dopamine, and dobutamine. Does that make sense? So you might not have on your test a question that says, what are the three treatments for cardiogenic shock? It might describe cardiogenic shock, and then you have to say what those treatments are. Or it might give you a treatment and say, what might they be treated for? Does that make sense? So you can't just memorize a set of facts. You have to understand the underlying meaning behind them and how to apply it. All right, so cardiogenic shock, we can treat with those three things. Now, the next type of shock was neurogenic shock. And in neurogenic shock, you lose the alpha-1 stimulation that makes your blood vessels about halfway. Remember we talked about your blood vessels can be 100% dilated or 100% constricted, but most of the time, where are they? Half, 50%. That way they can go either direction. And what is it that's telling them to stay at half at that 50%? What's it called? Sympathetic tone. So there's their sympathetic system all the time is telling your blood vessels, constrict a little bit, constrict a little bit, constrict a little bit, constrict a little bit. What happens when you lose that sympathetic tone? Blood vessels go wide open and you get neurogenic shock. So what would the treatment for neurogenic shock be? Oh, no, Dr. Eamon, we erased the alpha-1 stimulation guy. Okay, drugs that stimulate alpha-1. So, norepinephrine, dopamine, and we also said one other one that can also be used for congestion. Phenylephrine. The next type of shock was anaphylactic shock. And what was the treatment for anaphylactic shock? epinephrine. EpiPen, epinephrine subcutaneously. And then the last type of shock was septic shock. And we'll get a lot more into that for test three, but it's caused by an infection in the blood, bacterial infection in the blood. So the treatment for that is going to be, number one, antibiotics, get rid of the infection. And then we have to fix the other stuff that goes along with it. Again, we'll talk about that when we get for test three. So five types of shock. You need to know what they are, the general, what causes each one, and the general treatment for each one. And remember, I told you that the seniors, like Dr. Heyman, tell the students it's so important. They need to remember that because it's going to come back to the MedSurg 1, 2, and complex care. And none of us remember it. Well, yes, I told you that too, but you know, I'm glad that you know that now. So if you learn it now and don't forget it, it'll be that much easier later on. The last shock was called septic shock. S-E-P-T-I-C. Okay, so neurogenic shock is when you lose the sympathetic tone that keeps your blood vessels, your arteries, at about 50% in between dilation and constriction on an ordinary basis. And that's usually because of a head injury. Phenylephrine, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Patients sometimes have combined types of shock. They might have neurogenic shock and cardiogenic shock at the same time, for example. All right. Let's say you get into a car accident. You have a traumatic brain injury that causes neurogenic shock, and you already had a weak heart, and now you got cardiogenic shock, and you've been losing blood, so you're in hypovolemic shock. So, you know, you get an infection, so you've got septic shock too. So you can superimpose different kinds of shock on top of the same patient. So, in terms of beta 1 stimulation, the first thing we talked about was cardiogenic shock. We can use it to treat that. Now, what's it called when your heart just stops beating altogether? Cardiac arrest. So, remember, arrest was a fancy word for stop. So, cardiac arrest means heart stop. And there's a really, really technical word to describe heart stop. What is that word? Dead. So we don't just say dead because dead is, you know, kind of boring. But dead, you know, you're going to remember dead. So how would you treat dead? Well, for those of us who remember The Princess Bride, we know that there's two kinds of dead. There's mostly dead, and then there's all dead. And with all dead, there's really only one thing you can do. Go through the clothes and look for loose change. But with mostly dead is still slightly alive. And if you can perform the right miracle, you can bring the patient back to life.
Are you talking about heart failure now?
No, cardiac arrest. So, in cardiac arrest, your patient is
dead.
But there's two types of dead, mostly and all. So, if your patient is mostly dead, the heart is stopped, but it could come back if you perform the right miracle. What miracle would we use? All right, so for those of you who have your CPR, what is the number one most important thing to bring a patient back from the dead?
Shock
them. And in particular, what kind of shock do we mean? Defibrillate. So the first thing that should be done is defibrillate. Now, if the defibrillation doesn't work, then you can do your chest compressions, which will help keep brain and tissue alive and until something else happens. That something else is typically shock them again, hope it works again. Or you can administer a beta 1 agonist, epinephrine. Now, once you've gotten into epi, you are now in what's called advanced cardiac life support, which is a little bit beyond the normal CPR certification. So we can use beta 1 stimulants, especially epinephrine, as a miracle drug to bring your patient from mostly dead to alive. Does that make sense? And if you haven't seen The Princess Bride, well, you should. Several analogies will become more clear if you've seen that movie. Yeah, I know it's really old now, but hey, 33 years old now. So, but it's a classic. So we can use beta 1 stimulants for cardiogenic shock, these three. We can use it to bring a patient back to life whose heart has stopped, epi. And then we can also use them for what's called heart failure. Now, what is heart failure?
The patient's alive, the heart is leaving the body.
All right, so your patient is alive. Their heart is beating. It's just not beating enough to meet the body's demands. Now, there's two different types of heart failure. And on the next slide, after we talk about what heart failure is, there is a little statement, compensation and decompensation. Now, imagine for a moment that your blood pressure began to drop. What's your body's natural response to your blood pressure dropping? Sympathetic response. And the sympathetic response is going to cause vasoconstriction, that's going to raise blood pressure. It's also going to cause beta 1 stimulation. It's going to cause your heart to beat faster and stronger. So what's going to happen is, as the blood pressure begins to drop, your body will compensate for that decreased blood pressure. And so what happens is, a patient's going bad inside, but you don't see it that much. You know, you see them go like this, and then all of a sudden you see them go like that. Why is that? How many of you ever tried to balance on one foot? Your eyes closed. It's a little bit harder, right? Now, imagine for a moment that you're balancing and you begin to tip one direction. And it's slow, 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 and then all of a sudden, there's a point, and you can't do it anymore, and you fall really quick. Does that make sense? So, what happens when a patient's deteriorating in terms of blood pressure maintenance is that their body tries to maintain it for as long as possible. And so what you see is you see this gentle kind of like little slope, and then all of a sudden, the body just can't compensate anymore, and the patient goes, droom. Sometimes we call this crashing. All of a sudden, they just crashed. It's like they fell off a cliff. And what we're trying to describe is this idea that they were kind of stable. It was trending downwards, but it was okay until bam. Does that make sense? So, with heart failure, there's two major types of heart failure, compensated and decompensated, sometimes called chronic heart failure and acute heart failure. When your patient's in chronic heart failure, we're going to use other drugs. But when your patient's in acute heart failure, when they're in this like downward spiral, you can use beta 1 agonists to help them. And it's usually going to be norepinephrine and dopamine.
So is that for decompensation?
Decompensated heart failure, you could say that.
That's the same thing as acute.
Yes. There can be some slight technical differences, but for our purposes, yes. So, uses for beta 1 stimulant. First one we said was?
Shock.
Second one was?
Cardiac arrest.
Dead. Third one? Heart failure. What kind of heart failure? Decompensated heart failure. Patients who's crashing, that's going to be in an ICU setting. It's not going to be in a regular hospital unit. The fourth use for beta 1 stimulants is for what we call a cardiac stress test. Now, sometimes your heart has no symptoms when you're just hanging out. But if you demand something of the heart, let's say that you do some power shopping, and you begin to get chest pain or palpitations or some other symptom, but then when you rest again, it goes back to normal. Well, if we want to test and see what's wrong with that person's heart, what do we need to do? Well, we need to stress it out some. Now, what's the major way you would stress a patient's heart? Exercise. So we put them on a treadmill, and then we increase the speed and we increase the incline until the heart rate gets to the target rate, and then you see what happens. Now, what if your patient, for whatever reason, just can't exercise enough to get their heart rate up to that target rate? Or what if, say, they only have like one leg and they can't walk at all that fast? Or maybe if they're in a wheelchair, how could you do the stress test then? you give them a drug that stimulates beta 1 and causes the heart to work harder. Now, out of these, which do you think is probably the best one for that? Which one only affects beta 1? The dobutamine. So dobutamine is often used for stress tests. So there are four major uses for beta 1 stimulation. What are they? Shock. In particular, what kind of shock?
Cardiogenic
shock. Two was?
Cardiac arrest.
DAID. Number three? Decompensated heart failure. And number four? Cardiac stress test. Alright, so that's it for stimulation of beta 1. So now, let's talk about blocking beta 1. Now, what do you think is going to happen when you block beta 1? Oh, it's the opposite. Oh, sorry, there is one more use I forgot to mention, and that's in a patient with life-threatening heart block. You can give them a one of these drugs to increase conductivity of the heart. But usually that's a temporary measure, and the real solution is to give a pacemaker. But you could use that temporarily. All right, so I guess there's a fifth option. All right, so over here we have the opposite. Now, what reasons would we want to reduce a patient's heart rate? Okay, so if they've got tachycardia or if they have a dysrhythmia. So if the dysrhythmia is a fast dysrhythmia, a tachy dysrhythmia as they call it, decreasing heart rate and decreasing conductivity would be helpful. What's the fancy word for high heart rate? Tachycardia. So, patients with tachycardia, you can use beta blockers to slow down their heart. Another reason we could use a beta blocker is in a patient with heart failure. Well, Dr. Heyman, you just said that we stimulate beta 1 to treat heart failure. Yes, that's true. What kind of heart failure? Decompensated heart failure. But what about when a patient's in this heart failure up here? What's the body's response to decreased cardiac output? Sympathetic response. Right. Now, imagine for a moment that you, right now, as a young, healthy individual, your cardiac output begins to go down. Your body goes, sympathetic response. And what does your heart do? Oh, okay. Pumps harder and faster. Problem solved. Right? Right? But what happens if you're an older person with a heart that's weak and damaged? Your cardiac output begins to go down. Body says, sympathetic response. And your heart says, I'll try. But the effort actually damages your heart and makes things worse over time. Is the sympathetic response hurting your heart or helping your heart? It's hurting your heart. So, in patients with chronic heart failure that are not decompensated, we can actually protect the heart from too much sympathetic response by giving a beta blocker. So, we treat chronic heart failure with a beta blocker. We treat acute decompensated heart failure with a beta 1 agonist. So, chronic, you block beta 1. Acute decompensated, stimulate beta 1. Does that make sense? This, we block for years. This, you stimulate for hours to days. Patient's about to die any moment, stimulate. Patient's got a long time to live, but the damage is accumulating from too much sympathetic response over time. Block. Does that make sense? Okay. You can also use beta blockers to treat high blood pressure. By decreasing contractility and heart rate, there's going to be less cardiac output, so that will reduce blood pressure. Typically, patients shouldn't be getting a beta blocker if the only problem they have is high blood pressure. It's usually when they've got a underlying heart problem and high blood pressure, then they would get a beta blocker. What's it called when... What is a heart attack? How is that different than cardiac arrest? What happens in a heart attack?
Is it part of the tissue die?
Part of the tissue dies. Okay, so there is a blockage in one of the arteries that feeds the heart. What are the arteries that feed the heart called? Coronary arteries. So there's a blood clot in a coronary artery. Blood flow is blocked to part of the heart muscle. That heart muscle begins to die. Now, does your entire heart die? Not necessarily. Does the patient die? Not necessarily. So most heart attacks are actually survived, at least the first one. So the patient is living with a damaged heart at this point in time. Does a damaged heart work as well as a non-damaged heart? No. What is the body's response to that damaged heart not working as well? I'm beginning to sound like a broken record, right? Sympathetic response. Okay, just so you know, the correct answer to every question is going to be either sympathetic response or inflammation. So sympathetic response is your body's response to that heart that doesn't work quite as well. But what does that do to your damaged heart? It damages it even more. So, in a patient who's had a heart attack, we want to give them a beta blocker to protect the heart from sympathetic response. So, you probably are seeing a little bit of a pattern emerging here, that one of the major reasons we use beta blockers is to protect the heart from too much sympathetic response, whether it's because of a dysrhythmia, or whether it's because of heart failure, or whether it's because of a myocardial infarction. Any of those reasons are reasons why we would do that. Oh, no, not a question. Okay. We can also use it for blood pressure. We mentioned that. And then another use is for protection against other sympathetic responses. So there are some diseases that are characterized by large amounts of sympathetic response. One of those is liver failure. We'll talk more about that in Pathopharm 2, but just know for now that a patient in liver failure will be on a beta blocker because of sympathetic response. Another example would be pheochromocytoma. Remember we talked about that for alpha-1 with phentolamine? Well, that adrenal medulla tumor that's secreting too much epinephrine will not only be stimulating alpha-1, it will also be stimulating beta-1. So you need to give phentolamine as your alpha-1 blocker, but you would also want to give a beta blocker as well. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, there's one more use for beta blockers that we need to mention at this time, and that is performance anxiety. Test anxiety in particular. So, how many of you have ever come to a test or a competition of some kind, and all of a sudden you felt like your heart was pounding and the blood is pounding in your ears and your hand is shaky and you're trying to read words on a page or a computer and it's kind of blurry and you're like, and then you answer the stupidest questions wrong because your brain can't think. Ever happened to you? Why is that? Because of sympathetic response. The sympathetic response is preparing you to either fight or run away. And you can't run away from the test because then you fail. And if you punch the computer screen, that doesn't help either. So instead, you're just sitting there. And then you go, look how shaky my hands are. And feel how fast my heart is rating. I must be really nervous. And then that makes you even more nervous, right? Okay. So it's kind of like a vicious circle. Positive feedback loop. So, what they did, medical students, by the way, often have this issue, not just nursing students, and they did some studies in medical students where they gave them a beta blocker before they took a really important test, and the students did better because they were able to be calmer and more relaxed. Sounds pretty good. How many of you think you have test anxiety that prevents you from performing as well as you could? Well, you might want to consider a beta blocker in that case. Now, sometimes you might have a condition that prevents that. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. But it's certainly worth thinking about. Now, one of the downsides is taking beta blockers can impair your memory. So you might want to do that on a practice test day before you come to the real test. But that is a potential use for beta blockers. And there's one other issue that I didn't mention earlier, which is if a patient has a valve problem, a heart valve problem, like mitral valve prolapse, very common in young women, you can use a beta blocker for that, because any valve defect is going to reduce cardiac output, and then what's the body's response to reduce cardiac output? Sympathetic response. So you're protecting the heart from too much sympathetic response. We got a couple students over the years who've had mitral valve prolapse, MVP for short, and they were on beta blockers, and the entire class is freaking out. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that! And they're like, yeah, whatever, it's cool, man. Imagine for a moment that you get pulled over by a cop. You see those blue lights come on behind you, and what happens? How do you feel? It's kind of like shiver, like cold shiver goes down the back of your spine, right? And you pull over, and you're... And what does the officer do? Do you know why I pulled you over? You're like... Can I see your driver's license? So when you're on the beta blocker, you don't get that response. Say, cool, man. Now, for those of you who don't want to go on beta blockers and you still have test anxiety, here's a couple things that I would recommend. One is you try and do a mental trick, which instead of saying, I'm so nervous, you say, I'm so excited. If you can frame it as excited, then your body will go, yeah, this is good. Yeah, I'm, you know. You get a sympathetic response for being excited and nervous. So it's the same response, but it's a different brain interpretation. Does that make sense? So some people are really good at that, and that is enough to, they can do just fine. The other thing that you can also try is you could expend some energy before you get to the test. So the purpose of that sympathetic response is to get ready for you to do like big actions. Fight or flight. So what if you went to the gym and did some rowing machine or ran right before the test? Yes, maybe the person next to you is like, but you will be relaxed because you'll have used up that energy that your fight or flight was preparing you to use in the first place. And so that way you can be a little bit more relaxed going into the test. So those are two potential strategies that you can use that do not involve a beta blocker for reducing performance anxiety. The other thing you can do is like a ritual. Some people have rituals that they do before they, you know, I have to drink my coffee this perfect way. I have to have like this particular jacket on. And then the other thing that you can do is avoid certain persons. Nursing students tend to be like, oh my gosh, are you nervous? Yes, I'm nervous. Oh my gosh, I don't know this. What's the answer to this? Oh, I have to know that? I didn't even know that was a thing. And so if you avoid fellow classmates who you know are stress-inducing, that could also be a very good strategy in terms of before the test. After the test, it's fair game. But before the test, you got to be in the right frame of mind. Okay, so that's it for the beta blockers in terms of therapeutic uses. Now, let's talk about some adverse effects. So if you're lowering heart rate, what could be an adverse effect of lowering heart rate? Low heart rate? Yes. And what's the name for that? Bradycardia. So your patient could end up with bradycardia. And what problems can be caused by bradycardia? Decreased energy, fatigue. So fatigue is a really big thing with beta blockers. Some patients, when you first put them on a beta blocker, will say, I feel like I can't even get out of bed. I have no energy at all. It's extremely important to educate that patient that this is a potential adverse effect. If you feel that, it will go away if you keep taking it. Your body just needs to adjust to it. Because what happens if not? Let's say you have heart failure. One of the big things if your heart can't pump enough blood is you don't feel like you have any energy. Doctor puts you on a beta blocker. What happens to your energy level because you're on the beta blocker? Goes down. What does the patient say? Stupid doctor gave me this drug, made me worse. I'm not taking that. So now they're worse off in the end because they didn't take the drug. So you need to educate that patient. There's a potential that you might feel worse. You might have more fatigue and tiredness at first. But Stick with it, take the drug, and you'll feel better than you did before, eventually. Does that make sense? So you've got to educate patients in that regard. So, bradycardia, low blood pressure, fatigue, decreased libido, and erectile dysfunction are also possible. So you need to warn patients about that. It can also cause heart block. So the conduction system, it can actually prevent the heart conduction system from going through. That's called heart block. And it can also reduce a patient's sensitivity to hypoglycemia. Now, what is hypoglycemia? Low blood sugar. So let's imagine for a moment that you have a patient who has diabetes. And the person's got high blood sugar. So they're on drugs that lower blood sugar. Now, what's the potential adverse effect of a drug that lowers blood sugar? Well, too low. Hypoglycemia. Now, when a person's blood sugar is normal and begins to fall, what types of symptoms does the patient get? Get a little shaky, irritable, maybe a little sweaty, and they might have a headache, and we collectively call those symptoms hangry. Do any of you have a hangry friend? Are you the hangry friend? Yeah. Now, those symptoms, tremor, headache, shakiness, irritability, they're all a result of sympathetic stimulation. When your blood sugar begins to fall, it's still normal, it's just beginning to fall, you get sympathetic response that causes those hangry feelings. A person who's on a beta blocker doesn't experience those, at least not as strongly. So if a person is diabetic and they're at risk for hypoglycemia, they are less likely to notice those early signs of hypoglycemia. Does that make sense? Now, does that mean that a diabetic patient should never be on a beta blocker? No. What does it mean? They have to be more careful about monitoring their blood sugar than a patient who's not on a beta blocker. Does that make sense? All right. Now, before we can go... Oh, sorry. Let's talk about before you give a beta blocker. What's the number one most important adverse effect when it comes to assessing for these things? Bradycardia. It's bradycardia. So before you give a patient's beta blocker, you have to check heart rate. Now, there's two ways we can check heart rate. What are they? I guess it's technically more, but two major ways. One, you've already learned it in health assessment. What was it? You put your fingers on their radial pulse and you count the pulses for how long? 30 seconds, and then you multiply by 2. And then there's another way where you take your stethoscope. Where do you put it? Apical pulse. Some of you are saying apical and you're pointing to not apical. So, apical pulse, which is on the left side of your chest, fifth intercostal space, mid-clavicular line. And that is going to be up underneath the breast tissue on most people, even guys. It's like underneath your pec muscle. So it's not just on top, it's up underneath. So, fifth intercostal space, mid-clavicular line, apical pulse, and you listen and you count what? You count the number of beats for how long? 1 full minute, and that's called apical pulse. Which of those two methods do you use for a beta blocker? Apical pulse. And when do you do that assessment? How long before? Immediately before. So, here's how it typically works on the hospital unit. You get there in the morning at 6:45-ish, 6:30-ish, and you get your report on the patients you're going to take care of starting at your shift at 7 o'clock. While you're getting report, there is a CNA or a PCA who's going around and taking all the patient's blood pressures and other vital signs. They are then, around 7:10 to 7:15, typically, going to show you the list of everyone's vital signs. And you're going to write them all down. You got their blood pressure, you got their heart rate at that time. Now, it's 9 or 10 o'clock, it's time to give the beta blocker. What do you do? Check their apical pulse, then give them medication. So within 5 minutes of giving, you know, 5 minutes-ish before, you take the apical pulse, or even 30 seconds before. But you don't rely on their pulse from earlier in the day. Does that make sense? Do you need to recheck their blood pressure before you do that? If the blood pressure was okay earlier, you don't need to recheck the blood pressure now. But you always, always, always check the apical pulse. Does that make sense? A lot of students like to get this wrong. They're like, oh, blood pressure. I'm going to check the blood pressure. Yeah, you do check blood pressure. But it's that earlier blood pressure. As long as it's okay, you're fine. But immediately before, what do you check? Apical pulse. Now, what is the threshold? What would be so low that you decide, you know what, I'm not giving this beta blocker right now? Under 50. So, 60 is the threshold for bradycardia, but 50 is the threshold for don't give the beta blocker. Unless a physician has written orders differently, it's going to be 50. Does that make sense? So you got to memorize another number now. Sorry, that's how it is. Now, one thing that is extremely, 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 extremely important is you never hold a beta blocker and do nothing else. If you hold a beta blocker, you must notify whoever prescribed it. So you notify the physician or nurse practitioner or PA who prescribed that beta blocker. The reason why, a lot of the older nurses have a tendency to think of beta blockers as blood pressure medications. But what do you know they are? More than blood pressure medications. Heart medications. By the way, you know your heart's not over here, right? Where's your heart? It's in the middle. Like, there. So, heart medications. So, if a patient doesn't get their heart medication, a lot of times later that day they die. Or they go into a fatal dysrhythmia or potentially fatal dysrhythmia. And then they end up having to be coded or sent to the ICU. When if you had just told the physician at 10 in the morning, hey, so-and-so's blood, heart rate was 49 and I held their beta blocker, then maybe they would have said, okay, that's fine. Let's check it again in an hour. An hour later, it was 53 and you gave it that. But because you didn't give it and you didn't tell anyone, later in the day, their heart's not protected from the dysrhythmia, and they have the potential to die. So, first of all, just because the blood pressure is normalish to low, you don't hold it. The only reason you're going to hold it is if their heart rate is less than 50. And when you do hold it, what do? You got to notify the prescriber. All right. Good. Sure.
So you said that you would always check the apical pulse. Therefore, someone would have given beta blockers like at home,
Right. So that beta blocker apical pulse is something you're going to do in the hospital. Patients take beta blockers all the time at home, and they should check their heart rate before they do that, but often they do not. Yeah. But patients who are in the hospital are often sicker and more acute, and so we have to take that extra precaution. All right, so the next thing we need to talk about is beta 2. Now, and the reason for that, well, you'll see why. So beta 2 is present in, remember we said, two lungs? It's not actually the lung, it's the airway. What do we mean by airway? Trachea and bronchi. So in the bronchial tree is the main place, so we're going to have these beta receptors. And when we stimulate the beta receptor in the bronchi, we are going to get bronchodilation. And we're also going to have reduced sputum. But the main thing is bronchodilation. Now, what sorts of things do you think you could treat with that kind of a drug? asthma and COPD. That is exactly correct. So, beta agonists, drugs that activate beta 2, what do we use them for? Asthma and COPD. Now, we also have beta 2 in the uterus. When it's stimulated, it relaxes the uterus. Now, let's think about this, before we had modern medicine and houses and stuff, you're living in the woods, and you're about to give birth, and a neighboring army comes in to kill everyone. Do you want to have the baby right now, or do you want to run away? Hold the belly, run away. Which is probably the easier thing to do at that moment in time. So, under sympathetic response, let's stop the labor, get out of harm's way, then we'll have the baby. So, we can use this therapeutically. If a woman is in premature labor, we can give her a beta agonist to reduce the chances that she's going to give birth right now. And the drug that we use for that is terbutaline. Oh, and the drug up here was albuterol. There are some others we'll talk about when we get to respiratory, but albuterol is the number one drug used for that. Now, we have beta 2 in two other places. So we have beta 2 in the muscles. And in the muscles, it causes two things to occur. One is it's going to cause increased force of contraction. How many of you are stronger than you think when you are angry? Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. That's the whole premise of the Hulk, isn't it? How many of you are a mini Hulk?
I never get angry, Dr. Heyman.
You guys are looking like, I don't know what the Hulk is. Yeah, you know who the Hulk is. I know you've seen Thor Ragnarok. But anyway, when a person is angry or sympathetic response, they typically are stronger than usual. And part of the reason for that is the beta 2 stimulation. The other thing that beta 2 stimulation does in combination with cortisol is it increases the dilation of the muscle arteries. And that allows that blood that shunted away from skin and gut to go to the muscles. So alpha 1 shunts blood away from skin and gut. Beta 2 helps it to go to the muscles. Does that make sense? Now, we don't really have any therapeutic uses currently for beta 2 stimulation here. However, there is a beta 2 agonist called clenbuterol, which is a banned performance enhancing substance, which causes increased muscle performance and decreased fat, which we'll talk about later. So, if you're a bodybuilder, yeah, there's a saying that one of the things you should do is eat clen, which is like a play on words, eat clean, but eat clenbuterol, and then that will make your muscles stronger. The last place that we have beta 2 that we need to talk about is in your liver. And beta 2 there causes increased energy mobilization. Fight or flight, you need to run away or fight something, so you need more energy. What's the energy storage form in your liver called? Glycogen. And what is glycogen?
I don't know.
It's stored glucose. So it's a whole bunch of glucose molecules stuck together. So in order to release glycogen as glucose, what do you have to do? You have to chop up the glycogen into glucose. What's that process called? Glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. So beta 2 stimulation in the liver causes glycogenolysis. So clenbuterol works there as well. So patients who take clenbuterol tend to be stronger with less fat gain, which is why it's a banned substance. But it can also cause necrosis of your muscle tissue. So that's why we don't use it as a drug. But there are potential uses for it, but in our medical world, not the bodybuilding world, the only thing we're going to use beta 2 for is terbutaline and albuterol. And similar uses. So relax the uterus, preterm labor, increase the bronchi for asthma, COPD. Now, when it comes to adverse effects, though, when we block beta, well, we can get these as potential adverse effects, right? 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 Uh-huh. Yeah? I've lost you. All right. Let's take like a 3-minute break, and we'll come back, because I can see your brains are full. All right, so let's get going again. Hopefully our brains have been rejuvenated by relieving the pressure on our behinds. That's how it works. Your brain can only master what your derriere can tolerate. Oh, yeah, I think so. Okay. So what we're going to talk about now is what happens when we block beta 2. So in the bronchi, in the airway, what happens when you block beta 2? Well, you might not get bronchoconstriction, but you certainly inhibit dilation. So it's not that it causes constriction so much as that it interferes with patients who have asthma and COPD treatments. So when you have a patient who has asthma or COPD and they're being treated with anticholinergic and beta agonists, ipratropium and albuterol, if you also give a beta blocker that blocks beta 2, it will make their drugs less effective. Does that make sense? So it'll worsen their symptoms. So not all beta blockers are created equal. Some are selective for beta 1, and some are non-selective, and they affect beta 1 and beta 2. Does that make sense? The other big problem that we have with beta 2 is in the liver. Because you have decreased glycogenolysis, if a person has diabetes and they become hypoglycemic, they lose the late response to hypoglycemia. So the early response was the hangry symptoms. You lose that with beta 1 blockage, right? The later stage, once you actually become hypoglycemic, your liver is stimulated to release glucose by breaking down the glycogen. And you're going to lose that stimulation by losing your beta 2. So, patients who have diabetes can take beta 1 selective beta blockers with caution. They just have to be more careful about checking their blood sugar. But no diabetic person should be on a non-selective that also blocks beta 2 if they can help it. Does that make sense? So, when we talk about beta 1 versus beta 2 blockers, selective versus non-selective, non-selective do beta 1 and beta 2, selective does just beta 1, the big difference is what two things? Patients with asthma, COPD, patients with diabetes. Those two types of patients should not get non-selective beta blockers if at all possible. Now, let's just talk ever so briefly about how you answer test questions, because not all of your test questions are going to be multiple choice. You will also have some short answer questions. So, to help me help you get the points you deserve, let's answer the question and nothing but the question. What does that mean? All right, I'll give you some examples. Let's imagine for a moment that the question were, what does the fox say? Now, in first and third grade, you were taught to repeat the question in the answer. The fox says, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. Well, now, in adult life, that's the extra words I have to read and process. So instead of repeating the question in the answer, just say the answer. What does the fox say? Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. Yeah. That makes sense? Now, you're only answering the question. Yeah. What does the fox say? Well, cats say meow, dogs say woof, and no one knows what the fox says. But some people have thought that it may say wappa-poppa-poppa-pow. You see that? So yes, you answered my question correctly, but you also gave me a bunch of other stuff I had to read through, and now I'm angry at you. But the worst thing you can do is when you tell me something right and something wrong. What does the fox say? Cat says woof, dog says meow, and no one knows what a fox says, but it might be wappa poppa poppa pow. What am I supposed to do with that? Did you catch the problem? Do cats say woof? Do dogs say meow? So, okay, you got that answer right, but you got me other stuff that's wrong. So now do I give you 1 point and take 2 points off? So to help me help you, what should you do?
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple, stupid. Kiss, the kiss principle. But here's some students take these words so far to heart that they under-answer. So as an example, why would a patient with asthma be on this drug versus that drug? It's selective. Which one? Selective for what? What do you mean? Which one is selective? That's not enough information. So what you would want to say is that drug is selective for the heart and won't affect lung. Does that make sense? Or it's selective for beta 1, not beta 2. Now I know you know something. But if you just say it's selective, well, I don't know what that means. It's choosy who it wants to date. Does that make sense? So what you want to do is you want to answer the question as succinctly as possible, but make sure you actually answer the question. And the less information you give me, the less I have to hang yourself. Less rope you give to hang yourself with. So does that make sense? All right. So now let's talk about actual drug names. So far, I've just been talking about beta blockers in general. But as you've probably guessed, there's two different types of beta blockers. What are they called? Selective and non-selective. So I'm just going to write these over here. So we have selective. And what does that mean? Beta 1 only. They block beta 1. And then we have non-selective. And what does that mean? They block beta 1 and beta 2. So, the two drugs in the selective category that you need to memorize. First one is metoprolol. This is probably the number one most common drug you're going to see in the hospital and in the nursing home. So you're going to have more questions than you think is fair on your test on metoprolol. Just get over it. That's how it is. You need to know your metoprolol. The other selective drug you need to know is atenolol. Not nearly as common, but, you know, it's common enough that it's worth learning. And then in the non-selective category, we have two of them. We have carvedilol, and we have propranolol, which sounds like it has an extra R. Propranolol. Now, you might think that I've haphazardly written these in columns, but I've also written them purposely in rows. Because you also need to know that these two top ones can be used to treat heart failure. What kind of heart failure? Chronic heart failure. So, two of the beta blockers are not used for heart failure. Two of them are used for heart failure. You need to know which ones are used for heart failure. Does that make sense? Some of you are like, up until I said that last heart failure part, you're like, okay, I'm with you. And I added that one little piece of information and I decompensated your whole brain. Now you're like overwhelmed. So now you understand what decompensation is. Okay. So everything that we talked about earlier in terms of adverse effects applies to all four drugs. They all can cause bradycardia. They can all cause heart block. They can all cause fatigue. They can all cause low blood pressure. Every single one of them all causes all of those things. Every single one of them needs the same types of education, the same type of assessment. What was the measure assessment we needed to do? What kind of pulse? Apical pulse. So that applies to all four things. Now, when it comes to selective versus non-selective, what extra thing do we need to know about the non-selective? Don't give them to asthma or diabetic patients. And then the last thing we need to know is these two are used for heart failure. And that's pretty much it. Does that make sense? All right. On that note, we are done with beta blockers. There's only one drug left in neuro. How do you feel about that? Well, tell me how complicated this last drug is, and I'll tell you how I feel about it. It's actually one of the simpler drugs. So, do you remember when we talked about alpha-2 receptors? Where are alpha-2 receptors located? Okay, so they're located on the presynaptic cell. So here we have a norepinephrine neuron, and we have little vesicles filled with norepinephrine. And over here, you've got a cell that has either an alpha-1 or a beta-1, maybe both, but either one of those two receptors. The alpha-2 receptor lives on the presynaptic neuron. So when an action impulse comes down and the little norepinephrine is released, some of it's going to stimulate that receptor. As long as that receptor is stimulated, when the next action potential comes along, it inhibits these other nearby vesicles from releasing their norepinephrine. So alpha-2 has a kind of a negative feedback loop where it suppresses additional sympathetic response. It helps to prevent too much sympathetic response. So remember, you can have an action potential occurring at like 60 times per second, but you might only be getting 30 or 20 releases of norepinephrine because of this alpha-2. Now, there's one drug that you need to know that stimulates alpha-2. And that drug is called clonidine. So by stimulating alpha-2, it reduces sympathetic response. And the major use for it is high blood pressure. It's very, very common to use that or to see that drug being used in emergency rooms. You have a patient who comes in on the weekend or the middle of the night with a blood pressure of 180. You give them clonidine. Their blood pressure comes right down pretty quick. Okay, you're good. See you later. Go follow up with your normal doctor. We don't want to see you anymore. It's not an emergency anymore. Does that make sense? So that's the major use for clonidine, is to lower blood pressure. It does so really fast, but it also acts relatively short. So you typically have to take it 3 times a day. So it's not a great drug to give to patients long term necessarily, but it works pretty well for short-term reduction of blood pressure, especially in that emergency room situation. You can also give it as a patch, which can last up to a week. What route would that be when you put it on their skin, transdermal? So that's pretty much it for clonidine. Because it can lower blood pressure, or patients are at risk for low blood pressure, it can also reduce energy, and it can also cause bradycardia. There is one other use for clonidine, bigger use for clonidine, and that's still less than 1% of patients, and that is in patients who have severe cancer pain. If you inject it into their spine, what's called intrathecal injection, you can use it to help reduce cancer pain. Now, let's imagine for a moment. I can treat high blood pressure by giving a person a pill. I can treat cancer pain by stabbing a needle into their spine. Which one's more common? the pill. So high blood pressure treatment is more common. And yet, every single year, students will put down on the test that the most common treatment for clonidine is cancer pain. So here I am, telling you the question, telling you the right answer. I'm helping you to cheat. And students just spit in my face and get it wrong anyway. I don't want Dr. Heyman to teach me. I'm going to get it wrong on purpose. Take that. Right? Right, Libby. See? We had this exact conversation last year. And then after the test, what happened? Like 30% of people got it wrong. Do you want to get it wrong?
Yeah, I do. I want to show Dr. Heyman. He can't teach me.
All right, so that is it for neuro. Any questions about neuro?